This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
Good morning, 6 after on this Tuesday. Welcome to it, my friends. It's the Steve Gruber Show. Look forward to having a good conversation with you for the next 3 hours here. And a lot to cover today. Coming here shortly will be John Lott, the professor on guns, will join us to talk about the move by federal groups to expand handgun licensing, and then the federal government also getting involved with gun control measures in New York City and elsewhere, what it could mean to you. We'll talk to Dr. Lott about that. Dan Bishop will be here, Director of Relations for Consumers Energy, following up the conversation we've been having about the many coal-fired power plants that are going to be closing here in the state of Michigan by the end of next year as a result of EPA regulations. Avi Davis will be here talking about the celebration of sealing of the Magna Carta 800 years ago. We've got that at Royland Reed, diversity and sensitive expert. We'll talk about Rachel Dolezal. I've got an update on her here in just a minute. And Megan Barth, founder and proprietor of ReaganBaby.com. She's here just because I think she's fun. Plus, later, Larry Elder. Larry Elder from the Larry Elder Show will be here. Larry, of course, outspoken, the black libertarian. I don't know. He's just from Hollywood. One of my favorite guests, to say the least. So big show here today on the program. We started with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, though. Confirming early today that its leader and the terror organization's second-in-command, Nasser al-Wahashi, has been killed in a U.S. drone strike in Yemen. This is a big deal. Most powerful man in al-Qaeda killed since Osama bin Laden. A video statement released by the terror group's media wing confirmed his death and said that his deputy, Qasim al-Rimi, had been named as AQAP's new leader. Our Muslim nation, a hero of your heroes and a master of your masters left to God, steadfast, said a senior operative. In the name of God, the blood of these pioneers makes us more determined to sacrifice. Let the enemies know that the battle is not with an individual. The battle led by crusaders and their agents is colliding with a billion-member nation. No immediate comment from the United States. But this is, it's a pretty important development, to say the least. And seeing, for the most part, except for the lack of human intelligence, for the most part, I think that the drone campaign is pretty decent. And I guess I would say I would support the drone campaign overall. Another big success as far as that goes, but as far as the overall strategy, if there is one, in the Middle East and elsewhere with this president, well, it's lacking in so many areas, as you well know. Meanwhile, I have other good news from the terrorist front. U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters took control of a strategic town on the Syria-Turkish border. That happened late yesterday. ISIS militants were forced to flee and cut off a key supply line to the self-proclaimed caliphate's capital. The Washington Post reporting that the main Kurdish fighting force, known as the YPG, backed by affiliated Syrian rebels, had captured the town of Tal Abyad, claiming control of the town center by nightfall yesterday. The Post also reporting that the advancing forces had cut off ISIS's escape route from the town, surrounding it from the east, south, and west. The loss of Tal Abyad, some 50 miles north of Raqqa, the capital of ISIS's self-declared caliphate, is the extremist's biggest setback since the Kurdish fighters took control of the border town of Kobani near Turkey. Now, having said all this, Iraq will never be Iraq again, make no mistake. Iraq is gone permanently because the Kurds will never rejoin a nation which they are a small minority. The Kurdish are the best trained, best determined, most successful fighters in Iraq. Better than ISIS, better than anybody there, by the way. So the Kurds have fought back and they have taken control of their region. They're not going to give that back. This fighting has taken several months. The Kurdish victory deprives ISIS of a direct route for bringing in foreign militants and supplies and links the Kurds' two fronts, putting even more pressure on Raqqa. The anti-ISIS media collective based in Raqqa said the extremists had set up checkpoints in the center of the city on Monday and installed security cameras in the main square. So hats off to the Kurds this morning. Let's see, what else we got over here today? Let's see here. Ah, yes. My favorite transracial victim. Victim she is. She has resigned, by the way. Rachel Dolezal has resigned. She is the white woman who peddled herself as black all the way to the leadership of Spokane, Washington's NAACP, and has resigned as the scandal continues to burn up Twitter and the nation's fairly morbid curiosity. One commentator, a black man on CNN, said Rachel Dolezal must have, quote, mental issues to parade around pretending to be black when she is from Montana and of Czech and German descent. The big news is NBC has landed the exclusive interviews with Dolezal to begin later today on Today with Matt Lauer, and it goes from there. NBC made the announcements Monday on Twitter, and Dolezal will appear live in studio today. According to Variety, following her interview with Matt Lauer on NBC's Today Show, Dolezal will also give separate interviews with NBC News and MSNBC. She'll be sitting down with Savannah Guthrie on NBC Nightly News and Melissa Harris-Perry for MSNBC and NBC BLK, which I didn't even know existed. NBC BLK. Yeah, that's exactly right. That would be NBC News' African-American vertical online. They have their own black network. Dolezal's estranged parents appeared on Today yesterday, explaining that they didn't seek out their daughter, but rather were approached by a newspaper. Somehow they got wind of us as her parents and a possibility, so they contacted us to see if we are in fact her parents. Let me guarantee you one thing. I guarantee that she will be called brave by MSNBC and courageous by Savannah Guthrie. Here, we'll just call her for what she is. A fraud. A fraud who, by the way, back in 2002, sued Howard University for discrimination because as a white woman, she wasn't treated properly at Howard University, a predominantly black, historically black school where she went for her master's degree. So, you know, one year she's suing because she's white and another year she's suing because she's black, and you guys go ahead and line up behind her. Defend this behavior, because I'll just sit back and get some popcorn and watch MSNBC tie themselves in knots trying to justify this. 14 after the hour, it's the Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show. Jump starting your day with the news that matters.
It is 18 after on this Tuesday. Shane's in the building today. Ivy took the day off. She couldn't take him anymore, so she's joking, of course. Let's see. Jeb Bush got into the race. Gave a pretty good speech, I thought. You know, and at the end of the day, don't be surprised if he's the nominee. And if it were Bush versus Clinton again, I know. Trust me, I know. And I'll take your thoughts at 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966 on that thought. But if it were, I think Jeb, John Ellis Bush, get it, J-E-B, John Ellis Bush, would probably be your likely president, because Clinton's just having trouble everywhere. And now they've kicked out the yesterday to pull a stunt. A stunt is the best way to put it. David Martosko, a reporter for the DailyMail.com, a website affiliated with the Daily Mail in London, was rejected when he got there to cover the campaign yesterday. I got there when I was told to get there. 7:45 in the morning, I showed up in the parking lot, told them who I was, and they said, no, you can't come. He's the pool reporter. Let me tell you, this is how these things go. There's a pool reporter that basically feeds everybody else. All networks, like having a pool photographer in a courtroom, things that I was associated with back in my time at NBC News. And so that's how it kind of works, and they denied him the access, and the Clinton people are trying to play it off as well. The Daily Mail can sensationalize what happened any way they see fit for the readers. But here's the way it really played out. Major media organizations, other major media organizations, and Clinton's traveling press pool issued a statement Monday night defending Martosko and rejecting any attempt by the campaign to dictate who covers their candidate. We haven't yet had a clear explanation about why the pool reporter for today's events was denied access, said a joint statement signed by the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Tribune Publishing, and many, many more. So it's not just this one paper being denied. It's the entire organization, if you will. It's a pretty tight-knit group, these people that travel together, because they're always, they compete with each other, and yet they're colleagues as well. So there you go. Closer to home, multiple groups seeking to legalize marijuana in Michigan are hoping to put ballot proposals before voters in 2016, which means residents could be asked to sign multiple petitions this summer. Two groups have already won approval for the Board of Canvassers to begin circulating petitions for initiated legislation as they each attempt to collect the required 252,000, that is. A third group is considering a possible petition drive of its own. The guide, this gives you a pretty good outline of what is going on here. There's the Michigan Cannabis Coalition, MCC, petition approved as to form by the Michigan Board of State Canvassers. Organizers expect to begin collecting signatures in June. The legalization, it would say marijuana and marijuana-infused products would be declared lawful for anyone over the age of 21 to purchase, possess, transport, and use. Now, it's funny. I had a long argument yesterday about marijuana and its medicinal uses, which, yeah, there's some medicinal properties, some would claim, to marijuana. Okay. But they took issue with a column that I wrote where I said, marijuana is not medicine. And by and large, marijuana is not medicine, nor is it used as medicine, nor is it used for medicinal purposes ever. Am I wrong?
No.
No.
No, it was a roundabout way to get recreational marijuana.
Right, exactly. Now, there have been, you know, these stories and studies done that it can help people with glaucoma, obviously. We've known that for years. It can apparently help some children with epileptic seizures and so forth. We've heard those stories for some time. But the point that I was making in the piece that I wrote was simply that marijuana is not medicine as a general rule, period. And I stand by that, because the vast majority of those that use marijuana use it for recreational purposes. Now, if you're okay with that, that's fine. But let's be honest about what it is.
Well, at one time, I had an neck surgery, and I asked my doctor if I qualified for it. He said yes, but he would not write the prescription. I was not really interested.
So who did you go to?
I didn't go to anybody. I was just curious. No. But I just curious if I qualified.
Maybe you should. You might have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you should try that out, because you seem a little grumpy this morning.
It'll improve my appetite, right? Yeah.
Well, that's not never been an issue. Michigan's Comprehensive Cannabis Law Reform Committee, this is the MCC. LRC, their petition has been approved. Let's see here. The legalization. Anyone over the age of 21 would be allowed to purchase, possess, or use marijuana without fear of prosecution at the state or local level. The law would also apply to marijuana products such as edibles. A person could transfer up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana on private property or on public property as otherwise allowed by law. The proposal also includes language to legalize hemp farming. Retail marijuana sales would be subject to a 10% excise tax in addition to the existing state sales tax. Revenue would be divided between the Department of Transportation, 40%, the school aid fund, 40%, and the local government in which the retail store is located, 20%. I forgot to check where the money went on this other one. It doesn't really say, I guess.
You know, one argument against legalizing recreational marijuana is it will stimulate illegal sales because they'll be going around the taxes, just like cigarettes.
Well, yeah, but I think that I think the one argument that I, you know, the hysterical argument that I got to hear yesterday was, helps all these kids, and how can you stand in front of all these kids? Listen, it's not treated as medicine today because it's taxed. No medicine in this country is taxed. Either it's medicine or it's not, and you need to figure out which it is. And if there's going to be a medicinal purpose, fine, then study it and figure out what you're going to do with it. Anyhow. Let's make no mistake, the vast majority of marijuana in the state of Michigan is used for recreational purposes. If it bothers you, then don't vote for it. If it doesn't matter to you, then vote for these initiatives when they end up on the ballot in November of 2016. 25 after on the Steve Gruber Show.
This is the Steve Gruber Show, bringing you the news and newsmakers that affect you most.
Born under a bad sign. It is 33 after the hour on this Tuesday. You know, it seems like it's like a magician. Watch my hand over here. You'll never see what's going on over here, is the way this it seems so often. We're overwhelmed, inundated with, you know, stories and news and things going on, distractions all the time. Some of the news is big and relevant, and some of it's just a distraction that gets our attention. And then you look up from your little, your distraction, and you find that, you know, gun laws are being pushed again, you know, in pretty bold ways. Dr. John Lott here to join us to talk about this, the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Doctor, welcome back to the program, of course.
Oh, great talking to you.
So let's see, where do we start today? I'm going to start with people who would be required to obtain a license before purchasing some firearms under the Handgun Purchaser Licensing Act introduced by Congressman Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat from Maryland, and a trio of Connecticut lawmakers. The legislation also seeks to expand background checks to all handgun sales. And here's the part that maybe it's a misprint in the article, or maybe it's just silliness, and block people under the age of 21 from purchasing those firearms. I think you have to be 21 to buy a handgun anyway, don't you?
Right. Well, and as far as the background checks go, also, in order to go and buy a gun, you have to go through a background check in any case. Or, I mean, there's some states that if you already have a concealed carry license, then you don't have to go through another background check, but you still have to go through the background check to get the license.
So, right, here's the hook. Here's one of the hooks on this particular bit of legislation. States could refuse to implement the handgun regulations, but if they did, they would risk losing federal funding for doing so. So here it is. You know, you don't have to follow the federal rules, these new, you know, rules if we put them out there. But if you don't, we're just going to take your money away.
Right. Well, they just want to make it costly for people to be able to go and get guns for self-defense. And, the problem is that it's basically going to be poorer individuals who are priced out of being able to own guns. And, my research convinces me of anything. Those are also the very people who are in most need of having guns for self-defense. That it's the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime are the ones who need guns to be able to defend themselves the most.
Hmm. Here's the Handgun Purchaser Licensing Act would zero in on handgun purchases specifically and exempt rifles and other types of firearms, it says. Now, it is backed, this then, who knows, this article, you know, from The Hill. It is backed by a study from the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research that found handgun licenses dramatically reduce homicide rates.
Right. Well, I don't know if you saw this, but we have add a couple things up on that, at our website at crimeresearch.org. It's really a ridiculous study. I mean, they look at one state, they cherry pick the years that they're looking at with regard to it, and even how they do it. So, for example, they basically ignore the fact that firearm homicides, which is the one thing that they really look at there, were falling faster prior to this law going into effect in 1995 than they were afterwards. And, you know, one thing I try to explain to people is that, look, if you don't use all the data that's available, you really have to have a good explanation for it. And, of course, these guys don't explain why they only look at one state that has these laws. They don't explain why they picked the years that they did. I mean, you know, it's true that firearm homicides fell between 1995 and 2005. But what you have to do is you have to explain why it's falling slower there than it was beforehand, why they picked those years. I mean, if they looked at 2006, largely the drop would have disappeared. But you got to compare it to other places.
Yeah, cherry-picking, you know, your stats doesn't really, you know, give a very good picture.
Nationally, we're having a big drop in violent crime of all types over that. And in the Northeast, you were having a big drop there also. And so the question is, you have to explain, you know, if you just make a comparison there between Connecticut and these other states, you would, you know, it's hard to go and see why you should attribute the drop in Connecticut there to this law that's been passed.
So let me ask you about, so that's one story that made it to the pile here. They had one more, which is that the ATF is going to be joining with the New York City Police Department in fighting New York City gun crimes specifically. Apparently, a collective decision made by the feds and the NYPD, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, all these federal groups, those agencies mounting a first-ever anti-gun initiative in high-crime areas. And it doesn't sound like a first-ever to me, Doctor. It sounds like the same sort of thing we've heard before to give this, you know, I don't know what they're trying to accomplish here, whether it's for politics or what the real end goal is here, because it probably will have little impact on crime in New York City, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not even 100% sure exactly what the policies are that they're going to push. One thing is for sure, it's not the first time, as you correctly point out, that they've tried to go and focus on guns as a way to go and stop crime. And, you know, there are plenty of issues going on with how to go and use police and what have you to go and stop crime. But I don't think, you know, I'll be surprised if this has any beneficial impact.
Yeah, here's what the ATF agent, Charles Mullum, said. There is going to be, there is going to be an increase in federal arrests, no doubt. So what are they going to put, federal agents on the streets of New York City and arrest some people? Are these show arrests or show trials? I don't understand. I mean, does it have any real impact?
All right, well, look, I think police are extremely important in reducing crime, whether they're local police or federal police that are going to be there and reducing crime generally. But, you know, why New York City should get this benefit compared to other cities that have higher crime rates,
like Chicago,
not exactly obvious to me.
Yeah, Chicago might be the place you'd want to go. One other thing that they're going to do here, which I don't disagree with, if the ATF is involved in an arrest, they're going to figure out where the gun came from and see if there's some sort of an illegal gun operation. Okay, that's fine. Don't disagree with that. If somebody's getting straw purchases, okay, but you make a great point. Why New York? Why not Chicago? Or in the last month, why not Baltimore for that matter?
Right.
So it makes a good point.
No, I mean, you want to put police where the crime rates are highest. I mean, that's where they're going to produce the greatest benefits. And New York doesn't have anywhere near the highest, homicide rates or other violent crime rates in the country.
No, but it's easy to make a big show in New York and get a lot of TV cameras. There is that. Dr. John Lott is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, crimeprevention.org, the place to crime research, crimeresearch.org to find out more. Doctor, always a pleasure.
Great talking to you.
All right, there you have it. Dr. John Lott, everybody, and always informative and the best mind when it comes to guns in America. And he's here Tuesdays on the Steve Gruber Show, 41 after the hour.
Michigan's radio program of record is The Steve Gruber Show. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, it's 45 after the hour on a Tuesday. If you want to join the conversation, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. Andrew Langer back on the program, the president of the Institute for Liberty. Last week we were discussing the Obama trade and the TPP and so forth. Did not make it. Ran into some trouble there. Andrew, welcome back to the program.
I'm glad to be on.
So, all right. So, the part of this, you know, explain this to us that are a little slower than normal. What passed and what didn't pass there in the Capitol, and what does it really mean from a practical application when it comes to this trade policy battle?
Well, it's very interesting. The way the deal was structured, there was a suite of pieces of legislation that needed to pass. All of them needed to pass. And what did pass was the concept of trade promotion authority, the idea that Congress would have its power to gild the Christmas tree stripped. And so Congress would still retain the power to have an up or down vote on trade, and the president would, the executive branch would be able to negotiate those trade deals. What didn't pass was the trade adjustment assistance portion of it, which is this idea that if America loses workers, or the American workers lose out on their jobs, there would be some sort of retraining and some sort of financial compensation, et cetera. This idea that Democrats have been pushing for a very long time, that the workers who lose out would get something in return for it. Ironically, as a way of poison pilling the legislative package, it was the Democrats who had pushed this piece of legislation. They wound up voting against it, and so the whole measure failed, and now it's back to the drawing board this week with John Boehner trying to figure out exactly how he can get this package over the finish line.
What do you think? Is there any way to put this thing back together? Humpty Dumpty had a great fall.
Well, I think there is. I mean, I think it's a matter of sort of negotiating a little bit further on the TAA. I'm not a big fan of creating new entitlement programs, but on the other hand, if this is the way to get this measure across, and I think the measure was really underscored, the importance of this was underscored by an op-ed that Nancy Pelosi put in yesterday. And I want to reiterate something that I said on Friday, Steve, which is the whole purpose of trade promotion authority is to restrict the ability of Congress to put all sorts of gimmies and giveaways into the legislation. All sorts of, you know, if you have a free market limited government president who negotiates a free market limited government trade deal with somebody else, you don't want progressives on the back end, progressives in Congress, putting all sorts of garbage into the trade deal to advance their environmental agenda or their big labor agenda or whatever big statist agenda that they have. And so, you know, Nancy Pelosi yesterday penned this op-ed in USA Today in which she essentially admitted all this and said, we need to be able to, we as a Congress, first of all, she mistakenly asserted the power, that Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce, and as though that were a justification for the issues of trade deals. Well, no, it's not. Congress has the power to create laws that sort of regulate commerce and sort of regulate the individual sort of laws by which we engage in commerce, but they don't have the power to negotiate trade deals. And then she goes on to say that they want to retain this ability to put their environmental agenda into a trade deal if the presidency has failed to do so, or their big labor agenda into a trade deal if the presidency has failed to do so. And so, to me, Nancy Pelosi writes this piece completely justifying all that we've been saying about why TPA is needed. The Democrats don't want TPA because they want to continue to junk up trade with their philosophical garbage.
You know, and we're on the line with Andrew Langer here this morning, president of the Institute for Liberty. You know, this whole thing seems a bit messy, to say the least. And it's interesting to me to have Nancy Pelosi in the middle, the one that famously said, we need to pass it in order to find out what's in it. That's my best Nancy Pelosi, by the way, imitation. Yeah. That's best I got. And,
no, but Steve, let me tell you, you do a fantastic John Boehner. If nobody has ever told you that, your voice is uncanny. You could go into business doing an impression of John Boehner, and I mean that in the best way.
Well, there you go. Let me look. Somebody, who's got a light? Give me a cigarette. There you go. Spark it up, John. Does anybody even take that guy seriously anymore? I concern myself with that a little bit.
I mean, you know, it's one of these things where even when he's pushing a piece of legislation that that the president wants to sign, he can't seem to get it over the finish line. So this is a little disconcerting, to say the least.
I think John Boehner is about as useless a speaker as I've seen in my lifetime as far as effectiveness for a variety of reasons. I don't know what that is. Okay, so yeah, and looking, I want to focus on this one thing because this trade thing is not dead, and I want to focus on what you're talking about these. Job training programs and so forth for displaced workers and so forth. If this is such a great deal, this trade package, then why are we setting up all these possibilities, you know, to retrain and take care of entitlements for the workers that are going to be unemployed? I thought this was supposed to be a good deal for the American economy, and those things are a red flag to me.
Well, no, and it's one of those things where, again, this is one of those issues that was pushed by the Democrats in response to the president. I am loath to create new entitlement programs, but nevertheless, this is what the Democrats seem to feel the need to put up. Remember, they never let a crisis go to waste. So for them, this is an opportunity. It goes into the same thing with this progressive operative Curtis Ellis, who is the one who coined the term Obama trade, sort of pushing this idea that Americans are going to lose jobs so that it can then pave the way for the creation of this entitlement program under TAA.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen this decoupled. It looks like Boehner may go the other way and make it not a series of separate votes, but an entire package, which I don't know if it'll go through, but I think it ought to. They say, and I want to say it might have been Newt Gingrich who might have said the politics is the art of the possible. You negotiate things, and overall, because we are going to strip away a legislative power that has been abused and can be abused, and Nancy Pelosi is promising will be abused, I'm willing to sort of sweeten the deal in order to make that happen, because I think the American people benefit far more than they lose over this.
Andrew Langer, always a pleasure. Yeah, entitlements, $25 trillion and counting since the Great Society began rolling. Might want to look into that. Andrew, thank you for your time so much.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
There you have it. Andrew Langer, president of the Institute for Liberty, right here on The Steve Gruber Show.